You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Good to be back. My first day back at Norwood. I enjoyed speaking to a good crowd at Shady Grove last Sunday and commence a five-year journey with you, and we'll see how that goes. I'd like to acknowledge that Unitarians have been around in South Australia since 1854, and everyone, every sexuality, ethnic background, whatever your beliefs, you're all welcome here. We meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people, and let us respect their elders past and present.
Sin by George Herbert. Lord, with what care hast thou begirt us round? Parents, first season us, then schoolmasters, deliver us to laws. They send us bound to rules of reason. Holy messengers, pulpits and Sundays, sorrow dogging sin, afflictions sorted, anguish of all sizes, fine nets and stratagems to catch us in, Bibles laid open, millions of surprises, blessings beforehand, ties of gratefulness. The sound of glory ringing in our ears. Without, our shame. Within, our consciousness. Angels and grace. Eternal hopes and fears. Yet, all these fences and their whole array, one cunning bosom sin blows quite away.
Let's just spend a moment in silence, contemplating the foundation for our good behaviour to each other, coming not from the rules and sermons that we've received from people in our lives, but rather drawing on our own conscience, that inner self of ours which recognises the self in others. And now let's go to our traditional candles of joys and concerns. So I shall light the first candle, and the joy I wish to express is that we have people returning to this place after long absence, and that's always something to be celebrated and welcomed. Who of you would like to light a candle and express a joy or concern? Yes, I can light that for you. Very well, I'll light a final candle for those joys and concerns which we have in our hearts, but which we're not expressing today in front of everyone. Brothers and sisters, let's all be thankful for the family and friends we have. We bring them joy and they bring us joy through companionship, friendship, love and support, accommodation. They bring us a lot of joy, and long may that continue. May we be grateful. Now Margaret's going to play a hymn for us. The words have been distributed on sheets. Hopefully you'll find one on a seat near you. I'm on my way, and we're just going to sing the first three verses. Would you like to play it through once, Margaret? And then we'll all stand and sing. Thank you. Thank you, well done. And now Richard's going to come forward with a reading from one of the 20th century's great teachers, Krishnamurti.
Krishnamurti said this in his second Bombay lecture in 1953. What is sin? What is the thing that we call wrong action or good action? Please do listen to this. By listening, find out a release from all these words, so that in that release, in that creativity, there is no sin, there is no wrong direction, there is only a state of being, a state of love, which is never wrong. Since we do not have that, we have hedged our minds and our activity by what is good and what is bad. We are caught in this duality. And having been caught, we are trying to escape and create another antithesis of duality. To most of us, morality is tradition. We are slaves to circumstances, to society, to tradition, to what our neighbour, the boss, the government, the party says. Any form of deviation from the party lines is a sin, whether the party be religious or political. Any deviation, any wandering away from the traditional, from the respectable, is considered evil. And we have been nurtured, brought up from our childhood in that state. And so the desire to go against that which is traditional, we call sin. There is also the urge to conform, and the conformity is considered good, to be respectable. So our problem is not what is good, what is bad, what is sin and what is truth, but to be free from fear. The one who is free from fear shall know love, and one who loves knows no sin.
Well, that was beautifully read, thank you. And I can hardly improve upon it, but I offer some thoughts on the topic of sin today. I begin with an anecdote about two Jewish rabbis. Rabbi Moshe says to Rabbi Shem, "I have realized something today which has filled me with much joy." "And what is that realization, Rabbi Moshe?" "Rabbi Shem, I have realized that in my long life I have never sinned against the Ten Commandments." "But Rabbi Moshe, what about the other 603 commandments?" "Rabbi Shem, what do you mean, talking about so many commandments? Another 603? "Rabbi Moshe, it gave me no joy, but I read through the Tanakh, our holy scripture, and I counted exactly 613 different ways in which people can sin." "Rabbi Shem, I've just realized something else that fills me with joy." "Rabbi Moshe, what is that realization?" "I have realized, Rabbi Shem, that sins and blessings are the same in one important respect." "Rabbi Moshe, how can you say that sins and blessings are the same in any respect?" "Rabbi Shem, I have realized that whether it be sins or blessings, If you look hard enough for them, you will find them. I hope I don't get into trouble for the dodgy accents. But yeah. Okay, now for a quiz. What are the seven deadly sins?
Gluttony,
I've got.
Lust.
No, that's one of the commandments. We're still on the seven deadly sins.
Envy
is a good one, yes.
Wrath.
Sloth. Avarice. Oh, what's the other one? Here we are. Oh, did we miss? Did we have pride? Did we say pride? That's very important, yes. So there they are. Now, if you came up with any others, then you came up with a sin that the church hasn't thought of in the last 1,500 years. Yes. So what we currently have as the list of seven deadly sins goes back to Pope Gregory I in the year 590. And he built on earlier lists developed in the early Christian era, which in turn followed lists of vices prepared by various Greek and Roman writers. Why were they considered deadly? Because they were considered the most serious of sins. Not to be confused with the various crimes which might be committed by a person prone to indulging in one of these particular sins. By 590, traditional Christian theology had solidified the conception of the afterlife divided into two possible outcomes, heaven and hell. Indulgence in the deadly sins, otherwise known as mortal sins, could lead to eternal damnation in an unpleasant environment called hell. The more correct name for the deadly sins is the cardinal sins, but that may have created marketing problems, because the most senior Roman Catholic clergy, apart from the Pope, were known as cardinals. And I mean no disrespect to the 30th Roman Catholic Archbishop of Manila, the late Archbishop Sin, who actually was elevated to become Cardinal Sin. Now, a lot of thought went into these sins. There was a particular order, although it's no longer the way they're usually rolled out. Pride was considered the most grievous sin, since it was the root of all other sins. And you can see the psychological truth in this. If a person's ego fools them into thinking that their desires warrant fulfillment, despite the harm to those who get in the way, then they are capable of anything. Next, envy and wrath were considered more serious, as they were thought to be spiritual sins. And you can see that the other sins of avarice, lust, gluttony, and sloth all relate to the physical body. Like most spiritual traditions, the soul or higher functions were considered more important than the affairs of the physical body. Now, there were many other sins identified by the church which could be resolved through personal efforts at reconciliation. So, apologising for hurting someone's feelings with careless speech, for example, these lesser sins were classified as venial sins. They were pardonable. But of course, it was potentially rather too dispiriting to tell Christian adherents that they had committed a sin which would damn their soul to torture forever. Because faced with that prospect, people might think, well, I might as well just go out and do the lot then. Nothing to lose. So the Christian clergy spoke a lot about how you could escape damnation, even if you had been naughty. Hope springs eternally. So there were seven virtues which could be practiced, and also seven works of mercy which could be undertaken to counteract the gravitational force of one's sins. Now, the virtues and the works of mercy don't correlate one by one to the seven deadly sins, but it was quite convenient to limit the virtues and the works of mercy to seven each, because a list of seven is about as much as anyone can remember. So now it's time for the second quiz. Has anyone got one of the heavenly virtues they can call out?
Generosity.
Ooh, generosity. No, that's not in there. Well, charity. I'll pay that one as charity. Yeah, that's good.
Love?
Love, no, sorry, love doesn't really come into it. Gratitude, I haven't got gratitude, I'm sorry. You're not very good on virtues, are you? Humility? No, that doesn't come in either. Not well known in... temperance, yes, Janet? Yeah, temperance, so some restraint that way, yes. I think I better just show you the list. We'll go back to basics. Oh, that's what happens if you get them wrong. Got an image of hell there. Oh, and this is trying to decide what to do. Oh, here we are. Now, there were four cardinal virtues: temperance, prudence, fortitude, and justice. Beautifully portrayed on the screen in Victorian Ladies, that's right. And the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, familiar to readers of the Christian Bible. So now the third quiz. I don't know, I mean, it's getting harder as we go along. I hope you appreciate that. But we've got the third quiz, the seven works of mercy. Anyone? It's really struggling with works of mercy. I think I better just put them up on the screen. Here we are. To feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, shelter the homeless, clothe the naked, comfort the sick, visit the imprisoned, and bury the dead. Now, you may not get much of an opportunity to personally bury the dead, although in many parts of the world it is a live issue.
No.
Sorry. But now, a lot of this thinking, of course, was done in the Middle Ages, when a lot of Europe was ravaged by bloody wars, uncontrolled pandemics, and a lot of hunger. Unlike the list of deadly sins, the works of mercy was drawn from a precise biblical foundation. In the book ascribed to Matthew, chapter 25, Yeshua tells the parable about the sheep and the goats. And the idea is that at the end of everything, God separates out all of humanity into good and bad. And God tells the good people that they are blessed because they carried out the first six of the above-mentioned works of mercy. And the last on the list, burying the dead, was added in medieval times to round the list up to a nifty number seven. Now, there was also biblical justification for this one in the little-known Book of Tobit, or Tobit. Incidentally, the Book of Tobit is in the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Bibles, but not the Jewish or Protestant Bibles. One person's holy scripture is another person's apocryphon. Now, all of this talk of sin was given a huge boost by the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, when some very holy and clever people decided that Christians needed to confess their sins to the clergy, who were at that time given greater authority for remitting sins, in other words, forgiving sins and providing an off-ramp to the pathway to hell. The medieval period in Europe was possibly the heyday for talk about sin. Well, that worked out rather well. The exceptionally beautiful voice of Catherine Lambert, accompanied by Michael Bryant, in a song written by Adelaide composer Terry Bradford. So I'll continue with a few more thoughts. Of course, every society has its list of taboo behaviour. Most of humanity, though, agrees on what it is to do the wrong thing, especially at the more serious level. Judaism, and even more so Islam and Christianity, place a fair amount of emphasis on sin and the consequences for one's salvation. All three of these related religions incorporate notions of divine judgment, forgiveness, and serious consequences for the afterlife if one is found wanting. Of course, in each of these belief systems, there is only one life, so it tends to be all or nothing at the end of the day, or at the end of time. The Indian perspective is quite different. In the Hindu and Buddhist view, sin is acknowledged, but it is more peripheral than in the Middle Eastern religions. The world is an illusion. It's our human nature to strive for satisfaction, but we are bound to fall into error and suffer until we are sufficiently enlightened. As we make errors along the way, there is not necessarily a divine judgment which leads to our punishment. Rather, the law of karma takes care of it. The Hindi terms for the kind of harmful errors I'm talking about translate literally as a lack of skillful action. Lack of skill. Rather than an emphasis on breaching a divine code of conduct, the Hindu or Buddhist comes to understand that dealing with others unskillfully inevitably leads to an unpleasant correction, as surely as a law of physics. Act badly, and at some point the reaction will be sufficiently unpleasant to bring a realization that more skillful behavior is required. Which is not to say that rules of human behavior are not available for instruction. Millions of pages have been written on dharma, which is the duties that one has in life, whether an aristocrat or a street sweeper. Of course, the acceptance of reincarnation gives a very different perspective. The learning, the increasing skillfulness in human interaction, the steps on the road to enlightenment take place across lifetimes according to this perspective. This explains why we see some nasty people apparently die in peace and contentment. Their hurtful actions may catch up with them in the next life, where they may be on the receiving end of nastiness. Turning to the Kabbalah tradition, which is a mystical path which branched out of Orthodox Judaism, sin could be summed up as any action taken while disconnected from God. You might find it more helpful to think of this in other language, that we tend to act wrongly when we act inconsistently with our higher self, our best self, our soul. What would Carl Jung say? Well, he summed it up this way. One's worst sin is unconsciousness, but it is indulged in with the greatest piety even by those who should serve humanity as teachers and examples. We have our self, as Jung termed it with a capital S, and we have the ego mediating between it and the world. But the ego tends to grab whatever it can for its own advantage. And the process of maturity, or as Jung termed it, individuation, leads one to see others as being of equal value to oneself. And ironically, by committing oneself to community, by treating others as they would wish to be treated, as we would wish to be treated, we give the ego no work to do, and yet we are more authentic and more fulfilled than ever. The individuated person does not see others as identical, but sees them truly as they are in their own individuality, which is of equal value to one's own individuality. If one gets to this point of maturity, there's just no point in sinning, no point in harming others. It would make no sense, because it would be as if one were offending against oneself. What Jung might consider to be turning against the urgings of the self, or allowing the ego to block one's individuation, traditional Christian terminology, might be to say an offence against the Holy Spirit. Could we say with humanists and Buddhists that this also equates to not harming others or oneself and being true to oneself, In drawing these threads together, I offer the suggestion that sin, despite being such a loaded concept in our culture, is nothing more or less than causing harm to oneself or others. We here are people with a conscience, and the challenge is not so much about the right intention. The biggest challenge is to develop the temperament and wisdom to restrain our passions when they are at risk of causing harm. And the more subtle challenge is to discern how one's passions might lead to harm, no matter how innocuous they might appear at first blush. Rather than being bound up in self-censorship, probably the most helpful means of meeting these challenges is to constantly remind ourselves to be kind and gentle with one another and to contemplate the virtues. But I give the final word on avoiding harm to the Buddha, who taught this 2,500 years ago by being harmless to all living beings. One is a noble one. We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.